From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, dreams. Happy Canada Day, by the way, to our Canadian neighbors. Hope you had an enjoyable holiday. Here's what's happening. As protesters and armed anarchists seized control last month of a swath of Seattle's downtown that includes a police station, dubbing it Capitol Hill Organized Protest, or CHOP, the local and mainstream media largely echoed elected leaders by insisting it was a peaceful protest until people started getting killed. The spin by the national outlets that covered it ignored the violent and dangerous origin of the area that began on June 8th, when Seattle police abandoned their own station and allowed self-described anarchists to create a police-free zone. On Wednesday, today, police went back in and finished clearing out the area after multiple shootings, an alleged assault, and at least two murders. The coronavirus pandemic in the U.S. claimed at least 122,000 more lives than would be expected in a normal year, for a rise of 18% of the total death toll in the country, according to a study. It's not just you, but a lot of people are exhausted. If people were hoping to at least catch up on some much-needed sleep during the lockdowns, things may not have worked out the way they hoped. A new study suggests that life during lockdowns has left many Americans feeling more exhausted than ever before. According to a new study, 63% of the respondents reportedly fear that the damage to their sleep schedules will be permanent. Let's check in with Howard Bloom, author of The Genius of the Beast, his website, howardbloom.net, to get his take on the coronavirus. A lot of states are starting to lock down again, Howard. Not good.
Yeah, it's not good at all. So opening it for business as usual without a program of mass testing and isolation has proven devastating. Coronavirus cases are skyrocketing, especially in states where you think the warm weather would stop the spread of the bug. California, Arizona, Texas, and Florida. And younger adults are dying. In New Jersey, a 73-year-old grandmother and her sister died of the coronavirus, which you may think is not surprising. They were elderly. But three of the grandmother's 11 children also died of the coronavirus, and they were not elderly. We've had as many coronavirus cases in the last 4 weeks as we had in the previous 3 months combined. No wonder 16 states are putting the brakes on the reopenings. Those states are closing bars, indoor restaurants, and beaches. They're asking their citizens to celebrate the 4th of July with the members of their immediate household only. 80% of America's public fireworks displays have been canceled. Some governors are talking about returning to lockdown. And Arizona's Republican Governor Doug Ducey says bluntly, "You are safer at home, but lockdown does not have to be our fate. We can institute a crash program of testing and isolation. We can follow that up with contact tracing. Then we can go back to work and we can do it safely." Remember, testing and isolation is a powerful weapon against the coronavirus. If we'd ramped up testing as soon as our first coronavirus cases appeared in March, we could have saved 125,000 American lives. Now, how do we know we could have saved 125,000 Americans? South Korea tested and isolated as soon as the first cases of coronavirus appeared, and South Korea has had less than 300 coronavirus deaths. We've had 127,000. South Korea's death toll has been the size of a flea. Our toll has ballooned to the size of an elephant. But there's hope, and it comes in the form of what's called pooled testing. Instead of testing people one by one, you test their samples in batches of 5 to 10. If you find signs of the coronavirus in one of those groups, you look at the samples you took from the individuals in that group one by one, then you isolate the person with the virus so he or she can't spread it further, and you trace his or her contacts and test them, too. Pool testing has been used in China, Germany, Israel, and Thailand, but we need to do it on an Apollo program or Manhattan Project scale. Look, the world right now is laughing at us. The feeling is that if we are incompetent at handling the coronavirus crisis, then we must be incompetent at handling any major crisis, and we no longer deserve to lead the Western alliance. The proof of our incompetence is the fact that we have had more coronavirus deaths than any other country in the world. Let me repeat that. America's had more coronavirus deaths than any other country in the world. In fact, we've had more than the next four countries combined: England, Russia, Brazil, and India. We have to stop this incompetence. We have to stop this politicization of a public health crisis. And we have to test, even if it means that the government has to harness private industry for test production and test analysis the way that we harnessed private industry in World War II. Now, the principal deputy director of the CDC, Dr. Ann Schuchat, says it's too late. She explains, quote, "We're not in the situation of New Zealand or Singapore or Korea, where a new case is rapidly identified and all the contacts are traced and people are isolated. We have way too much virus across the country for that right now, so it's very discouraging. We have to prove Dr. Schuchat wrong, and turning pool testing into a national priority could just do the trick."
I'll tell you what's just strange, Howard. Have you met anybody or do you know anybody who has the coronavirus personally?
Not a soul.
Nor have I. I conducted a survey today of about 12 people, and nobody knows someone who has it. Now, isn't that weird?
Here's the deal. One of the doctors I run into in the park with his dog is a geriatric specialist. He has lost, as of 3 weeks ago, he had lost 122 patients. Another doctor is a friend of mine who is, he loves emergency room doctoring. He does not love it right now because he says people are coming in who are healthy and strong, aside from having minor symptoms, and 2 days later, they're dead.
Strange stuff. Thanks, Howard. Federal Reserve policymakers are looking at reviving a Great Recession-era promise to keep interest rates low until certain conditions are met, in a bid to deliver a more rapid recovery from the recession triggered by the coronavirus pandemic. Let's check in with registered investment advisor Mitch Shedlock. Michael, what do you think of all this? The market still seems to be strong.
I think it's strong because the Fed is essentially promising it's going to keep interest rates low for many years. I was actually disturbed by the report today. They came out and they're targeting the markets, George. They can't deny it, they are denying it, but it's obvious that it's the truth. But they came out today and said they're promoting this idea that a quickening of the recovery is going to take many years. And I'm sitting there thinking, what kind of 1984 talk is this? That's what's coming out. And tonight I'm researching a story right now that's really bothering me. And this goes back to what Howard was talking about, that we're not doing enough testing. Our biggest trading partner this year, surprise, people might not be aware of this, is actually Mexico. It's hopped over China into our number one spot for 2020. Half of the people in Mexico are testing positive for the coronavirus. And the Mexican health minister came out today and said more testing is a waste of time, effort, and resources. I'm sitting there thinking, what? The only way that can be possible is if Mexico is so broke that they cannot afford to pay for tests or to have the economy shut down. So what does that say, looking back to the U.S., when our largest trading partner is in such dire straits? So if we add what Howard said to what I'm saying, you know, we're in trouble. And yes, we really need to do more testing, George.
All right, Mish, thank you. Mish is a website, of course, is part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Sorry, we have in the news at coasttocoastam.com. Go take a look at it because you will see a picture of a two-headed baby. Doctors are now caring for a two-headed baby in intensive care with two sets of organs as it fights for survival. The co-joined twins share one body, according to doctors in Uzbekistan. Very rare, one in 200,000 or 220,000 cases. Such children can live a long life. They can live up to the age of 30 or 50 as well. It's a strange. I mean, you'll see two heads on one body. It is absolutely bizarre. In some cases, this has been done, and they have removed one of the heads. Now, that I find to be strange and a little inhumane. Early Wednesday, NASA astronauts Chris Cassidy and Robert Behnken conducted a spacewalk outside of the International Space Station to replace lithium-ion batteries with one of the station's power channels. They give it about 20 more years of lifetime. It's an amazing little situation there. Up next, space historian Robert Zimmerman back with us. We will talk about his investigation of the Wuhan flu panic. And, of course, we will talk about space with him next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We've got a wonderful program for you tonight. Robert Zimmerman back with us, award-winning space scientist and journalist, a historian who has written four books plus and numerous articles on science, engineering, and the history of space exploration and technology. He reports on space and science news at his website, behindtheblack.com. And there's a big anniversary, the 10th anniversary coming up. We'll tell you about that a little bit later on. Robert, welcome back, my friend.
Hey, George. It's always a pleasure to be here. Glad to give your listeners another 2 hours of cool space stuff.
I want to talk a lot about space, but let's get into something you've been looking at, and that's the COVID-19 situation.
Yeah.
What caught your eye, first of all, to start writing about this?
Look, I'm a science journalist, and so I always focus very much on data and what the actual information is coming out. When this started to appear from China back in January and February, I started to dig in on data. My science reporting for years has told me, do not trust any scientist or politician who depends on models and predictions for what they're going to do or what they say is going to happen. The models are very unreliable. They're not a tool for figuring out what's going to happen. You've got to begin with the data. And so I first looked at the data initially coming out of China in South Korea on the initial Diamond Princess ship that got trapped with patients on it with COVID-19. And you're looking at the data and looking at studies that were done, that original data, it told me, one, this is not going to be that big a deal. It's going to be basically a variation of another flu. It shouldn't be taken lightly.
Mm-hmm.
It may be a little worse. It may be worse, but we shouldn't be panicking and destroying our entire society. We shouldn't be nullifying the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. And I wrote that. I said, this is really doesn't look like it's going to be that a big deal. And then they started to cancel conferences. I was going to go to a planetary conference.
Canceled many that I was going to. Same thing.
Yeah. They will cancel a whole bunch of stuff. The people are starting to panic. My local caving clubs, they cancel all events. And people won't meet. And I'm saying, this is crazy. And so I started to dig even more. And it made no sense. It was totally a panic. It was totally hysteria. And I followed this repeatedly now for the last 3 months. I keep checking the data. Look, during your news segment, you had this maniac on. I'm sorry. Don't be gentle about it. Talking about how, oh, my God, all these cases, increasing cases. We're going to die. So many more cases. We've had so many more cases. Well, that's total idiocy. Yes, we have more cases because we're aggressively testing more. We are doing pool testing, by the way, and have for the last month and a half. That's why the number of tests are going up.
But I think they also have the seasonal flu deaths mixed in with that number.
Maybe so, but put that aside for a minute. We're testing, so you're getting tons and tons of more tests. But you know that the death rate continues to drop or is flat? Now, what should that tell you? What that should tell you is that the disease is running its course. We're beginning to have herd immunity. People are having the disease, but they're not dying from it. And if they are dying, they're dying almost exclusively if they're old and the elderly sick. The elderly sick more than anybody else, just like the flu. We don't panic about the flu. You know you might get sick. You'll be uncomfortable days. You'll recover. You know that if you're 80 years old and you have a chronic disease or already seriously compromised, a flu could kill you. Everyone knows that. But when you're young, it's not a problem. And in this case, if you look at the data once again, across the board, you don't die if you're under 50. This is not a problem if you're under 50. It kills almost no one under 50. If you're under 60, slightly more, but not significantly. If you're under 80, it only starts to really kill you significantly if you're sick, which, of course, older people tend to.
Well, we've had, now here's the catch-22. We've had 125,000 deaths, but I ask the question, from what?
Well, you see, now that's the second thing. I had a long essay I wrote about a week ago in which I looked at the numbers, and I posted an essay about this continuing blind panic. And I point out that it's actually not 125,000, it's 122 deaths. Well, those numbers, one, if they're labeled coronavirus or COVID-19 or the Wuhan flu, it's been repeatedly told to us by numerous experts in numerous states and nationwide that those numbers are almost certainly inflated by 25 to 50%. So 125, take off one-third. So you're up to 80,000, right? Then there's the next thing. Flu deaths are down this year. Why? I wonder why. It's because they're assigning every death to COVID.
Exactly.
That might have been a different respiratory disease.
Yep.
You remember now, a lot of these deaths that are assigned to coronavirus are presumed or probable by symptoms.
If you go into the hospital, die of a heart attack, they'll say, well, he was positive for COVID, he died of that.
That's exactly what's going on. There's a political game going on here. I'm sorry. When the politicians, mostly Democrats, overreacted to this and shut the economy down, they needed this to appear like a plague to justify their overreaction. So they are doing everything they can to pump up the numbers. And the places that the numbers are being pumped up most of all are in places like New Jersey, New York, and Colorado.
Florida?
Not Florida so much. In democratically controlled states that, and I'm not trying to be partisan here, I'm just talking facts, they are pumping up their numbers. So now, let's get back to the disease itself.
And California.
California actually hasn't had much disease because it's very
I know, but they're telling you like it is. I mean, today they implemented brand new measures again.
Now, yes, they've
shutting down restaurants and everything else.
But in terms of actual deaths, it's relatively small, and that's because it probably got there much earlier than the rest of the country, and they achieved herd immunity much sooner before the panic.
I think we had it in this country way before. We may have been, let me tell you a quick story, Robert. We may have been one of the first to report on this Wuhan situation back in the end of December, early part of January. I, as you know on this program, we like to cover the unusual and the strange. And I saw this little tiny story out of Wuhan, China, that said someone has a disease caused by a snake or bat that they ate at a market. Now, I saw that and went, that is a weird, weird story.
Perfect for your show.
But the next day, I found out that there was a viral lab in Wuhan, and I went, this is weird.
Yeah.
There aren't any coincidences in my book. I have a feeling.
Not that kind, not with China.
Somebody played around and experimented. Now I find out that the National Institutes of Health gave grants to that lab.
Yes.
I mean, this thing is bizarre. And the other thing that bothered me was the daily headcount of illnesses and sick people around the world that the mainstream media was doing. They had never reported on the seasonal flu, which kills up to 60,000 Americans every year, up to.
Yeah.
And well, they never reported on that.
Well,
but they would say 12 people have the Wuhan flu in Spain today. 15 in Italy have died every day.
Yeah.
And it created that hysteria that we have today, where now this whole country is almost shut down again.
Let me point out about the numbers I was just saying. Let's say, even if the number is 100,000, let's say it's only slightly inflated, that is not significantly more than a bad flu season. Not significantly at all. It is also significantly less of a disease than the Hong Kong flu in 1968. The year they had Woodstock. I don't remember them canceling Woodstock. I was alive, so I know.
You're still alive, aren't you?
What?
You're still alive.
Yeah, I'm still alive. That's right. I wasn't worried about it then. No one was. This is nothing more than a slightly worse flu. It's like the flu in this respect, in terms of its magnitude. And to panic is ridiculous. And the worst part of it is how politicians have been using it not to cure people or to reduce the the disease, but to obtain power. Because if you were looking at this from the beginning and the data, it was very clearly, and you can go to early posts I did about this in late February, long before it really got here and anyone had panicked, and the data said very clearly it's only going to affect older people. So if you really care about saving lives, you don't shut down the society, you protect the elderly. You make sure they are protected and they're quarantined, and you allow society to go on. But what instead do politicians do? They shut down the society, they quarantined the healthy, and then they sent infected people in states like New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and I think Ohio. They sent infected people. They mandated.
Hold on for a second, Robert. We're at a break. We're going to come back. We'll talk more about this. Then we'll get into space on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, back with science journalist Robert Zimmerman. Robert, let's talk a little bit more about COVID, then move on to some space issues, of course. So your thoughts on COVID, hysteria made up. What's the intent? Is this? I have heard a lot of stories about this.
Well, I want to emphasize something I was trying to say just when we cut. You don't want to have lots and lots of people die from this thing, so you do take it seriously. And the one thing you do is you focus on where the threat is worst, and that's what these people did not do. They put Andrew Cuomo mandated that sick people had to be brought back to nursing homes where there were vulnerable people. You do the opposite. You protect them so they don't get hurt by it. And we didn't do that. So what did we do instead? What these politicians have done is take advantage of this panic, which they helped instigate, to gain power. And they have now set the precedent that they can, with an edict, put everyone in the United States under house arrest, governors, mostly governors. They can put everyone under house arrest. They can force you to wear a mask. There are no standards for the masks. I've researched this. It's probably unhealthy.
I'm not sure they work
the way most people do. And this is despicable. It is a power grab. That's the sum total of it. And you can tell how much of a power grab it is by the arbitrary nature of the closures. In New York State, religious organizations can't meet. Jews cannot worship at their synagogues or teach their kids. But it's okay for a Black Lives Matter protest of 100,000 people to gather packed on a street. That just indicates an arbitrary nature. It means it's a power game, and that's all it is. And that's where it's coming from. And unfortunately, Americans don't seem to care that their freedoms are being destroyed right now. And they are being destroyed. There's no doubt about that.
Because when you scare them, Robert, they will follow you.
Well, remember the last line in the Star Spangled Banner, land, home of the brave, land of the free? Well, you cannot have freedom without courage. If you are not brave and you're willing to be scared and allow fear to, you know, the only thing to have is fear itself. If you allow fear to dominate you, then you cannot be a free person. And I am not going to live in fear. I'm going to live as a brave American free. And I'm disgusted by the fear that I see radiating from everybody for something that, once again, the stats, even in their worst scenario, makes it nothing more than a slightly worse flu season. Well, the worst flu season we've had maybe since the 1969 Hong Kong flu.
I've heard some people say the COVID-19 will go away after November 3rd. The election.
Like many other of these kind of things, yes. A lot of this has to do with the hysteria on the left about Trump. They don't like the fact that he's in power, and they just don't like it. And they've been going nuts for 4 years about this, 3 years, and they keep piling on with something new every time. And, you know, it's not entirely partisan, because there are also Republicans playing this game because they want the power. It's not totally possible.
No, you're right. You're right.
So anyway, let's talk about space, which is the positive thing that's been going on in the last few months. Despite the hysteria, it's positive.
What do you think of the privatization of space?
Well, this is something I've been writing about for decades. I wrote a policy paper in 2017 called Capitalism in Space, and it was a policy paper for Washington Think Tank that was basically distributed throughout the D.C. area. And what has essentially been happening over the last 3 years, especially within the Trump administration, is they are embracing the basic ideas that I suggested. And I'm not the only one that's been suggesting it, so it's not just me. But the basic idea is that NASA doesn't build anything. NASA is a customer that has a need. The United States has a need to have a presence in space. And so what the American dream and the American way of doing things is, if the government is a customer, it is a servant to the people. When it needs something done, it doesn't build it itself. It hires Americans to do it for them. You hire private companies, which will then own what they build and be able to sell it to others as a custom, as a product. And so the Trump administration has been steadily transitioning to that model. It is a transition that began with the Obama administration. This is not partisan. Obama administration pushed hard for its 8 years to commercialize space, to take it out of NASA's hands, the construction of spacecraft. And that's why it was the Trump administration could accelerate it so well. And that's why, just a month or so ago, a private company launched a private Americanly built capsule on an American rocket from American soil to put two astronauts into space successfully, and they're still up there a month later. The capsule is doing great. And they built that capsule, the Dragon capsule from SpaceX. They built it for a tenth of what NASA has cost over the years, and in no time at all compared to what NASA.
Right, and they probably used some of the ex-NASA employees to build it.
No, absolutely not. Very little. Very few people.
Well, where'd they get the brain power?
People at SpaceX come out of NASA, and the reason is because NASA teaches bad lessons. If you worked at NASA, you don't think the way you need to think to work for a private company. You work slow, you work careful, you make a lot of models, you don't cut metal, you're conservative in terms of how you design things. The way SpaceX works, and one of the astronauts on the mission, I think it was Bob Beneke, said the thing that makes this struck him about SpaceX is its agility. They change, they rethink, they don't get married to any idea, and they can change it on a dime. They accept error, they accept failure, they blow things up to learn how to build it right. That's something NASA does not do. And so very few engineers at SpaceX came out of the NASA.
Well, where'd they get the brain power so quickly?
Well, there are plenty of smart people in the United States. Remember, Elon Musk, who founded the company, came out of PayPal. That's how he made it.
I mean, he put a rocket company together in how many years?
Very few years.
Yeah.
He started this idea in about 04. He was launching his first Falcon 9 rocket and capsule in 10. In only a decade, the Falcon 9 rocket has gone from nothing to now the most used operational American rocket. It's bypassed the Atlas V. It's just the most
amazing
recent launch. And so what he did was he went and looked for young, smart people who wanted to do this work but were not bogged down with the old bad ideas. Remember, for 50 years, I was told by NASA engineers, NASA management, big management at the big companies like Boeing and Lockheed, the launch companies, it was impossible to reuse a first stage. You couldn't land it vertically. It wasn't possible. If you did, you wouldn't have enough fuel to get your capsule into your payload into orbit. And even if you could, when it landed, it would not be usable to use again. They said it was impossible. They didn't even try. Well, they're lying. Or they were just simply not capable of thinking outside the box to innovate.
Or both.
And so this is why SpaceX has succeeded. He went with young people and open-minded and innovative, and that's why they're successful.
Beneke was one of those who did the spacewalk today.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, they are changing batteries on ISS, and this mission was originally only supposed to be a week long, initially. It was only supposed to be a demo. They go up, they show it can work, they stay for a week, and the astronauts come down. But in the last 6 months, NASA decided, you know what, maybe we can make it a little longer. And when they launched, they said it was going to be anywhere from 1 to 3 months. And now it's going to be an almost three-month-long mission. Basically, it's not a demo. It's basically an operational mission. Because they realized, you know what, private enterprise does it better than big space, governmentally-funded operations. SpaceX has high standards. It wants to meet those standards, and it does it repeatedly. Because what it's doing is it's trying to win customers. The only way you win customers is you produce a good product that's reliable and that's inexpensive. And that's exactly what they've done. They have reduced the cost to launch from what was routinely $1 to $250 million per launch to now less than $50 million. They probably actually are much cheaper than that, but they don't have to be cheaper because nobody else can even match that price.
How far advanced is SpaceX from Jeff Bezos' company, for example?
Oh, far advanced. Bezos has been very disappointing me for the last 2 years. He's proposed to do some of the same things, but he decided to wed his company to the government and the military, and so he's building his rocket to their specifications, which immediately slowed down production by a year. and he has not produced. You know, he was flying the new Shepard suborbital craft for the first time 3 years ago, and they said they were going to be starting to launch people on it within months, and that's 3 years ago, and they haven't done it yet. And so I've been very disappointed with Jeff Bezos. SpaceX is doing something right now that is even more revolutionary. I'm sure, I don't know if you've talked about it on your show, but they have something called Starship. And Starship is the second stage, but can also be used from the ground. And Super Heavy will be the first stage. And basically what it is going to be is an entirely reusable rocket. But not only that, it's going to have the capabilities of superior to a Saturn V rocket. So not only will they be able to put up payloads comparable to the Saturn V, but the rocket will come back down and be completely reusable. And they've been doing tests of Starship in Boca Chica, Texas, near Brownsville, the tip of Texas, for the last year. And in that time, they've built 7 prototypes. They've blown up 4 of them. They did one of their early prototypes, Starhopper. They actually did a 500-meter, 1,500-foot vertical up and down. But they're blowing up their prototypes because they're trying to test the failure to figure out how to build it better. And they've got the 5th prototype right now on a test stand. They're doing more engine tests with it. If everything goes well, and it's, I expect this time it will, because the tests have so far worked out right, they're going to do a 500-meter, which is about 1,800-foot hop with that. And if that works, they're going to then move to a 12-mile hop. And if that works, they hope within a year to be orbital. Now, that doesn't mean there will be orbital in a year. These are tests. This is a development process. It might take longer. But considering the fact that they've only been started a year ago with actually cutting metal, they are going to be – they will be flying this thing probably within 4 or 5 years.
That's amazing.
And then, you know, compare that to NASA's Space Launch System, which they started in 2004, and it will not have its first manned mission until 2024. That means 20 years to do a single mission, and it'll cost them almost $60 billion. It's going to cost SpaceX about $2 billion to develop Starship.
Several months ago, I got a call during Open Lines. Robert, someone said, I saw a whole string of UFOs in the sky. And I'm going, what the heck was that? Well, I found out it's Elon Musk's link of all those satellites he sends up.
He's launching something called Starlink. And it's going to be a constellation of satellites that could be in the in over like 8,000 satellites, but they hope to have enough launched, something like 1,000 by the end of this year, and it will be offering worldwide internet capabilities to the world. And they are using their Falcon 9 rocket and its reused first stages to launch it, which means it costs them practically nothing to get these rockets up, these satellites up. And so he is going to be in the position to offer everybody internet service probably at a cheaper rate than your Comcast or your Verizon.
Just amazing.
Or your Centrelink is offering. And it will be something that will work anywhere you go. And so that's, once again, he's just doing smart business. He's offering a product that will be superior to others for less cost. And, you know, it's all smart business. And he hopes to use the profits from Starlink to help fund a Starship, which he is offering to NASA as a product to get people to the moon. He's also using it to maybe get himself to Mars, to build his own Mars colony.
How far advanced is he from most countries who are trying to develop a space program?
Right now, there is nobody, no company, no private company, no nation that is even close to what SpaceX is doing. I would say the closest country to what SpaceX is doing right now would be China. Because China, first of all, China steals the ideas from us and then upgrades them.
Right.
And they've been very aggressive about doing that, stealing it. But then they do upgrade it. And so when they saw first stages being landed,
they reverse engineer it, don't they?
The grid fins, and they've been trying to control landings, and they kind of think about trying to get first stages to land vertically, and I'm sure some of it's been stolen from SpaceX. So China's the closest. In terms of the United States, private companies, all the private companies are not being that very competitive. They're not innovative enough. They've been slow. What's been competitive has been the newer companies that are coming along, something like Rocket Lab, which is a small company, small rockets, but they're very close to already being able to reuse their first stages. Very quickly, they adapted and are thinking about how to do it.
And I had heard that Tesla Motors, which Elon Musk owns a lot of, has surpassed Toyota in terms of size. Can you believe that?
I'm not as enthusiastic about Tesla as I am about SpaceX. There are certain issues there that are complicated.
But he seems to succeed at everything he touches.
Well, there was a great video I put on my website, Behind the Black, which, by the way, is celebrating its 10th anniversary.
Well, happy anniversary, Robert.
That's right. I'm having a fundraiser, in fact, this month, asking donations to keep me going. But it is the 10th anniversary. I've been doing this for 10 years. Hard to believe. I've had almost 1,000 essays, 22,000 posts. But anyway, I posted this video where Elon Musk was interviewed, and what he said was that, this is a quote, if someone came to you to tell you that what you've designed is a bad design and I have a better idea, you would be insane not to listen.
Exactly.
And that's what makes him good. He's
a good manager will listen.
That's right. He will listen, and he will, and he changes. His designs get one of the reasons they're doing these tests with Starship is because they want to find out what works, and they're changing design as they go aggressively so they can get it to be the best it can possibly be. And that's why he succeeds.
Good point. Since you've been doing this, and like you say, you've been doing it at least 10 years.
I've been a writer
for
almost 30 years, a space historian. I've got lots of books that are available on the history of space, and I have written the book on the Apollo 8 mission. I've written the book on the history of the Hubble Space Telescope, and I've written the book on the history of space, manned space post-Apollo. And those are all on my website. But 10 years ago, I needed a website where no one could stop me. I could write whatever I wanted freely, because I've been very frustrated over many years how editorial departments in magazines and among publishers repeatedly tried to make their opinions my opinions, and they would not allow me to speak my mind. And so I made my webpage. And so Behind the Black's been here for 10 years, and I get to say what I want. If I want to write an essay today, I write it, and it's published today. I don't have to go through an editorial process. It would be nice to have copy editors, but I don't have the money yet to afford that, because I make typos all the time, and my readers are my copy editors. They tell me about typos, and I fix them. But I get to write what I want, and so for that reason, for the last decade, I've been doing this. And the website's growing exponentially. It really is, and the donations come in surprising how many. People don't have to give me any money, but they want to, because they want to support what I'm doing.
It's amazing that we are approaching this month 51 years since we first landed on the moon with a man.
Yeah.
51 years. That's half a century.
Half a century. And the fact, it's a disgrace that it's half a century and we have not been back. And even more
important, why did we stop?
Well, we stopped because we decided, and this is what I talked about at length in my book on the Apollo 8 mission that orbited the moon on Christmas Eve, Genesis story of Apollo 8. We took the wrong lessons from the space race. We went into the space race, as Kennedy said, to prove that a free people could do it better. But we copied the Soviet Union by creating a program run by the government from on top.
And then stopped.
And we've been copying that model for the last 40 years, and it's only in the last decade that we're starting to abandon that model and allow, instead of a space program, a chaotic space industry of many different companies and people following their individual dreams with no government decision on how it should be operated. By having a government command control on top, nothing gets done. And that's what happened a little.
Good point. Robert, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back at the top of the hour and start phone calls with you. Robert Zimmerman, his website, BehindTheBlack.com, linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. And as he mentioned, 10th anniversary. He's got a little fundraiser going there. Throw him a few bucks. Keep him going. We'll be back.